This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by HP Plus. In a world full of smart devices, isn't it about time your printer got smart too? Now printing is smart with HP Plus, and the HP Smart app is how it all happens. You can print from your phone with just a tap, no matter where you are, even from your garage / home office / yoga studio. Huh, that is smart. HP Plus. Learn more about smart printing at hp.com/smart. This episode is brought to you by PayPal. These days, choices are everywhere. Like, for instance, the milk in your coffee. Would you like it from a cow? A nut? A tree? Everyone wants options. And now your customers have a new option in the way they pay. With PayPal in person. Just generate your unique QR code in the PayPal app for them to scan. And start accepting PayPal in person today. Learn more at paypal.com/US/getQR code.
Hello and welcome to episode 162 of the Washed Up Emo podcast. I am Tom Mullen from washedupemo.com. And today we welcome Scott Hobart, singer, guitarist, and lyricist for the band Giant's Chair. Giant's Chair are a Midwest band that in the early 90s influenced many in the scene we know today. Starting out in the legendary Caulfield Records, Giant's Chair have been on and off over the years and continue to be talked about when this genre and era is mentioned. Now, they're about to release their new album, Prefabilon, on December 6th on Spartan Records. If this is in the future, it is now on streaming services. I think I giggled and laughed more than any episode with Scott as we talk about the band's history, his kids, his day job, and the new album, Prefabilon. I really hope you enjoy it. If you are a Patreon supporter out there, that literally means the world. I cannot believe that you spend money to help me support this show and this podcast that I do in my spare time. Thank you, thank you, thank you. If you want to support, head on over to patreon.com/washedupemo. This is episode 162 with Scott Hobart from Giant's Chair.
Around my grandma and my mom's mom, she played guitar and she played piano and also lap steel, like Hawaiian guitar. And my dad played guitar and sang around the house, just kind of didn't really, it was just like around the house all the time. So definitely grew up with guitar around, but I didn't get interested until I was probably about 14 and I started playing and then started writing stuff immediately because I definitely was, I took a few lessons. My mom said she'd give me a guitar if I took lessons, and luckily had a cool high schooler guitar teacher who would be like, okay, here's this and this and this. And then I would bring songs and he'd the next week he would show me how to play those parts or those songs, So it was more kind of like, what do you want to know how to do on the guitar? And let's figure that out,
What kind of stuff were you asking him to teach you first?
Well, I was way into early U2 stuff at that moment. So I was pretty much, it was like, hey, how do you do Sunday Bloody Sunday? Or how do you play New Year's Day solo or something? It was that kind of stuff. And the Church and REM and, I just was kind of into, I guess at that moment it would have been college rock, early alt or something. My folks were, they were listening to country radio was really what was going on at our house. But my mom did have, she kind of, like, one time I asked her, because I had heard on just a radio station out of the next bigger, you know, the bigger town over, the college town, I had heard some Pink Floyd. And I asked if she had any Pink Floyd records, because by then I knew she had a record collection, and that there was, I knew she had some rock. I knew there was Creedence Clearwater Revival and Janis Joplin. And so I asked her about that, and then, but she didn't have that, but she did have Bob Dylan's songs from Big Pink, you know, the band, I guess. To answer the question of how I heard that other stuff would be like radio. There was a really good college radio station, and still is, out of Rolla, University of Missouri, Rolla at the time. And the station was KMNR. They always were playing crazy stuff all the time at all, you know, all hours. And so you could kind of get that. I was also into skateboarding and stuff. And my friends in that town, the college town, who were skating, were listening to a lot of other stuff that I got my head around too, you know, Descendants and they had bands too. And so they had punk bands or whatever, you know, just thrown together and stuff. So I kind of started getting a feel for that. And then, you know, I had a girlfriend from early on who I traded a British flag bandana for. She was from Maryland. She had come out. She had a cousin in my town, and she showed up, and I traded this British flag bandana for a B-52s cassette and some other mix cassette with, like, you know, some early new wave stuff on it. And that was pretty influential, I guess, at that moment too.
I love that. You traded a bandana for B-52s and, like, a mixtape.
It's exactly what happened.
That is a sweet trade.
I thought so. And she was pretty, so that was good too.
You know, your ears were perked to different, you know, the college radio station in my town played weird stuff. I picked up on it. I'm like, they're not playing mm-hmm. what I'm hearing outside or on the radio or from my friends. Like, they're playing something different. And then your punk friends were kind of giving you other stuff that you hadn't heard, but you were not rejecting it. You were taking it with all ears and probably couldn't get enough. Why was that? What about those sounds, or what about those things that weren't on the radio for the most part connect with you?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think somewhere early on I don't think I ever realized that it was a Rush song until later, but I had heard a Rush song and it surprised me, like the changes surprised me. And I think maybe that was something that kind of made me realize that there was stuff out there that would surprise me. And that was, I think, something I sought out at some point, or was at least open to, like you said, my ears were ready for that. The element of surprise that was intriguing to me. You know, I was never real good at math, and I always liked to draw and paint and stuff, and was always a daydreamer and by then also into music and stuff, but not music. You know, I was in choir, but I hated it and stuff at that, you know, early on. But I guess my mom had said, well, you know, it's okay. There's an art school in Kansas City. You just keep drawing and we'll see if we can get you into art school. And so she at least had the notion that there was an option for someone who wasn't, you know, playing small town football very well. And so, so I got, I think I was just, I could draw and I liked to paint so I went to the Art Institute for 2 years, and the first year was, it's Foundations is what it's called. And it's like they kind of start from scratch and just kind of give you a taste of every direction, you know, photography, figure drawing, or, you know, projects that have to do with, you know, honing your, you know, craft, making sure you can cut a straight line if you want to, you know, that kind of stuff. And so I did that for a year. And then the second year I did go into painting and printmaking because it was kind of wide open. And in fact, I think I was doing more sculpture-y type stuff in painting, but it also, I brushed up against printmaking at that moment, which kind of fed into the graphic design of that it takes if you're going to be in a band as far as making posters or flyers or whatever.
Yeah, it was you were accidentally being a great asset to your band.
Exactly. Yeah. And even more band. Yeah, even later it got even more, which yeah, that was later on. After Giants Chair got together, we came back to Kansas City and I was trying to find a job, and I ended up in a print shop at that moment, thanks to my father-in-law. So he was in printing and he's like, "You know, you should check out printing." You know, it's like, okay.
Wow. Yeah. Were there bands before Giants Chair?
When I got to Kansas City, I guess I was kind of at that moment, I was into Bob Dylan and, you know, kind of the folk singer thing. Then when I got to town and was doing acoustic stuff, when I met Byron, the bass player from Giants Chair, we were kind of doing the coffee house thing, acoustic duo. He was on bass and I was on acoustic guitar. So yeah, we had a couple of bands here and different drummers, but then we ended up in Green Bay playing with Paul, the Giants Chair drummer. Byron and Paul are both from Green Bay, and we ended up moving up there to play with him after Byron and I couldn't quite find the right fit for a drummer here at that moment. And we had nothing else going on really, and so we just were like, "Hey, let's go check out Green Bay."
Yeah. And what was it like when you all, you know, what was it like playing together for the first time? What were some of the things that, or sounds or bands that brought you together as you started to play?
I'm going to get away from this lawnmower for a sec. I think he's about done with this part. Sorry about that.
Is this a neighbor?
Yes, it's just the next door neighbor.
Tell him you're doing a podcast interview. He needs to finish up.
Bill, come on. Help me out here.
I got a record coming out.
Come on. I'm trying to. Oh, yes. Well, that's all what you noise. Get for talking to washed up emo dudes. Anyway.
People mowing lawns.
Yeah. It's just, you know, our bucolic existence of lawnmowers and every year. I knew Paul. I mean, Byron grew up there with him, but I had known him, and we had actually played with him once when the previous band had gone up, and our drummer couldn't make it for probably some college reason. And so Paul had sat in with that band, and so we knew kind of his vibe. And so basically, we, you know, when we moved to Green Bay for that winter, it ended up just being for the winter. Honestly, I don't quite remember the first time we got together, and kind of, to me, it was the snare. Like Paul was he's a really straightforward drummer ultimately. And I loved that. And I loved that he was more about snare than toms, you know, I just love snare. Boy's life later, but as far as the immediate, like peers that were making sounds that I was like, oh my gosh, these guys are really doing this, you know. With Molly Maguire, they had two guitarists and they were often playing close to the same thing. And I loved that sound so much that I've got two amps and started running stereo because we didn't want to, or we didn't have another guitarist. And I guess we didn't really, I don't know, we didn't look for one very hard, but we wanted to have that sort of sonic impression live. And I just liked the way that sounded. And so that was a huge influence, I'll say.
That's cool. And then for singing, what did you like about your voice when you started singing?
My mom, when I told her I was going to drop out of art school to be in a band, or drop out of school, college, to be in a band, and she's like, "Well, what are you going to do?" I was like, "Well, I'm going to be the singer." And she's like, "You can't sing." I was like, "Oh, well, I don't guess it'll stop me. I'm going to just do this." And I don't know that I really necessarily felt like I was a great singer, but I liked to sing and I liked to try to write songs, and had been since I picked up a guitar. And I do think that I ultimately, when I started understanding, you know, punk, I guess, I realized that it was less about carrying a tune than it was about carrying an emotion and, you know, a passion or something. You know, it was just like, you know, it was authentic, just, you know, blurt it out, bleed and see what happens, you know? I mean, I remember, so with Germbox, I remember them bringing the, you know, their demo tape around or their EP tape. It was a cassette, and him playing it, Dave, the singer, and, you know, cause we were close friends and it was, we were in the dorm and he played it and I was like, oh my gosh, these guys are really doing it. And it was at that moment that I decided that it was, you know, that's what I wanted to pursue. And so then later on when bands like Season to Risk and Boys Life were really, you know, hey, you know, they're in LA tonight or they're in Wichita tonight, you know, so that kind of thing was, you know, again, it was just like up in the ante and it was like, well, we can do this and it's in reach and we can be a part of this and, or, you know, we can get out there too and just, you know, be a band on the road, you know, that we're ultimately a bunch of romantics, I think. And we just, you know, loved the idea of being able to try to, you know, live the journey dream.
Right. But that time, like, that was attainable. You know, you had a 7-inch in your hand.
Yeah.
You might have had some t-shirts and you drove and there was hopefully the kid answered the phone at the payphone that you called from at the gas station and you showed up and hopefully there were people. But I think what I'm getting at, and I think there's sort of a difference then and now, which I think happens in every scene, but I think this scene was a little bit different because the internet started to, you know, take hold at the end of your you know, first sort of iteration of Giant's Chair. But I think those inklings were there of things getting faster and stuff changing. But then it was still very, it felt slow, even though at that point you didn't know anything faster.
Right.
But now it seems slow. But I guess the question is, you know, connecting with bands, you know, meeting up with Christy Front Drive or Ethel Meserve or, you know, getting with Caulfield Records. Like, it wasn't like you and I emailing back and forth to get this like time set. It was a letter.
Yeah.
It was a phone call.
Yeah.
It was a voicemail.
Oh yeah. That's so huge. Yeah. I remember, we would a long time of sitting at a table at the Giant's Chair house where Boys Life practice and Season to Risk and us putting together the packages and being on the, you know, leaving yet another three messages with all these clubs going across, you know, and then Boys Life had gone through, they had achieved a tour of the whole United States. And we were then calling, like they would be playing these places and we would call like a day or two later, I would call while they were on the road and say, hey, we're going to be coming back through with Boys Life, on, you know, next month, you know, or 2 months from now. Anyway, just, yeah, but all by phone, right, yeah, phone and mail, much slower, so thank goodness for the internet, I suppose.
How did you get in touch with Caulfield?
Oh, yeah, so through the guys from Germbox, they had, I think they did a 7-inch on Caulfield, and then we also had seen Sideshow. I mean, they were out and about doing the, you know, touring too, which was another, they were heroes, and we had seen them at a couple of places around the Outhouse and some other place. And so, I mean, it was just, I think we sent a demo tape probably to Bernie and then I just remember we were in, I guess we were in Green Bay. We had recorded. We had made our own 7-inch, the Hot Boy 7-inch, and we sent it to him. And then he was like, "Yeah, I'll pick this up." And then, would you guys want to do a record? And we were like, "Yes, of course." And so, we were in the process of writing this, you know, the full record batch of songs, or a full set batch of songs, I should say. It was mostly, the idea was just to be able to play for a show. And And so, yeah, I mean, it was so exciting whenever he called back or left a message, I think is probably what he did, was, you know, just to get that message of, yeah, let's do this. And to have someone who you were looking up to already, you know, on and because they're in a band, but they also happen to run this label and they're willing to help you get a record out, is, I mean, that's pretty magic.
Yeah. Do you remember any reviews or things back then that helped get the name out there or help Giant's Chair?
I think we had something in Flipside that made us feel like we'd gotten some traction. I remember playing like opening for Love Battery one time at this place in Kansas City. And I thought, man, we're making some headway, or, you know, we're at least like, man, this band is so cool that we get to play with them. They were a Sub Pop band, I think. And I also remembered probably the more impressive on me were just being able to play these basement shows where there were actually a bunch of our friends really legitimately rocking out, and like us feeling like we were connecting and, you know, actually sounding good after all this time. I mean, those moments are really the priceless moments of, you know, a sweaty basement that is rocking hard and you're there and you're doing it. And that's huge.
When you guys moved on from that, you had other bands that you guys did. Like, what was it? What was it for you personally? Was it, I got to get some other stuff done, or I got to have a job, or what was some of the stuff that the first time you guys had stopped?
I remember us kind of after the Purity and Control record and tour, kind of getting back together and trying to start write some things, and it just wasn't really happening, and we weren't ready, you know, we weren't going to force it. And I had already, I'd kind of at the moment felt a little disillusioned in that I knew, you know, there were times when I felt like, oh, we're playing these basement shows. Of course, now those are the magical moments that I remember as being so cool. But I also, it wasn't genuine or something, you know, I felt like it was, you know, it could never be as true ultimately, like every show couldn't be full on, fully emotionally true and transparent as it was supposed to be. And so I kind of felt like it was disingenuous, and it had been kind of a process of elimination for me musically. I wanted to, you know, I'd kind of been pushing the limits of what I could do on guitar, and I wanted to go the other direction to some extent and write very basic songs, like with regular C, G, and F. And I wanted to write story songs, and I wanted to, you know, and I wanted to create a character. I don't know. I kind of went through this whole mental identity crisis kind of thing, and emerged as a country singer somehow. And so I started writing country songs, really, you know, songs, just very straight up songs about heartbreak, which in a way, when I look back, I mean, I think that every song I've ever written has been a heartbreak song, probably. But so there were all those factors that went into it for me. I don't know about Byron and Paul, what their things were, but then they went on and were, you know, continued in different rock bands that I think were great, you know, great fits for them. And so they evidently were not done rocking at that moment. I just wanted to do something else. You know, I kind of just wanted to see what would happen in a way if I just decided to do these, you know, write country songs and make country records. So, which in a way, I mean, it's still a very simple form. You know, I feel like, so sometimes it's country or folk is more punk rock than people give it credit for sometimes.
And by then, in 97, you still hadn't heard the word emo.
I probably had, but I also know that we had...
I love this.
Well, I also know that we were always reluctant to try to give in to, and actually this all fits together because I remember one thing that I really liked about being in a country band after all this was being able to simply say, you know, someone asked, well, what kind of band, what kind of music are you guys doing? It's like, well, I'm in a country band. That's very straight up, you know, and I could have all that time said I was in a rock and roll band, but you know, Giant's Chair, I felt like for me, we didn't want to be pigeonholed. You never want to be pigeonholed. You just want to be able to be like, I don't know, you know, we're just doing our thing. And, but then, you know, ultimately I did not want to just say we were this or that. Ultimately we were just a rock band and still are just a rock band. In fact, that's what we strive for, is to be a rock band.
There was a time period where, you know, I would reach out to these bands and they wouldn't respond, or I don't want to talk. I mean, it was that jarring of a phrase even then to not be associated with it.
With emo?
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I mean, to me, it's funny because my country band drummer at one point, you know, we were on the road years later, and you know, he was asking about Giant's Chair, and we, you know, we were saying, well, I guess we were considered emo, and he's like, what, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, all music's emo, everything's emotional. and I was like, yeah, I understand. And so sometimes I think about it like that too, but yeah, I mean, any genre, I mean, any genre is a comp, you know, is a, you know, it's just a handy thing that somewhere, you know, someone said, well, that's this, which is
totally
cool, you know?
But it's also community.
Exactly.
It's also community.
Exactly.
I mean, the bands you guys were touring with and playing with, and the community, Caulfield Records, like whatever that was,
yeah,
that name was attached to it. Good or bad.
Oh, yeah.
But
oh, no.
I don't think that would have happened if it was a shoegaze scene.
Yeah.
Or like a super indie rock, like, you know, Athens, Georgia kind of thing. Like, would it have been that same response? Hey, no, I'm in a shoegaze band.
Right.
Or I'm in an indie rock band. Like, no, I'm in an emo band, it's like, what? Like, it's marginalized.
Yes. Yes. So you feel like that the emo as a genre was a marginal genre.
It still is marginalized. If you mention it to anybody outside, I live in New York City. If I go to Times Square and ask 10 people, they're going to, you know, three are going to laugh. Four are going to say hair. two's going to say tight pants and white belt. And one person might say, you know, sunny day real estate.
Yeah.
But I think why I brought this up and why I think talking to you is that a lot of the bands on are from maybe the mid to late 90s, and then they kind of cut into the 2000s. But for you guys to have that first swing, you know, in this really sort of cultivating incubator era, mm-hmm, with, you know, 97 was a lot of times people think, you know, a lot of the I missed you guys. Like, I barely caught what you guys were up to before I started to really go to shows, really,
yeah,
see record, you know, get to the record stores, find out what was going, mm-hmm, on. I found out about Tree Records too late. I found out about, so my, what that, even then in 97, it was like, nah, dude, I'm doing a country band.
Yeah.
That's what I'm fucking like, I'm out of this shit.
Yeah.
Like this. And it's so funny that still happens. And there's, and I think for you guys, my follow-up was sort of a, you know, as the years passed, like your drummer asking you about your old band, like, did you start to feel, because that's when I realized that this might come back, or the full history would come back, when bands would say, oh yeah, I remember Boys Life. I'm like, wait a minute, I don't even think I could find an article online about Boys Life. Like, how do you remember them? Did you start having people you know, say, hey, I remember that band, or like, did any of that start to permeate at some point in the late 90s or early 2000s?
I mean, anytime anybody does, you know, decides to even, you know, mention you as in any way, you know, influential or, whenever Byron, our bass player, who he's always, you know, he's always digging around on eBay and stuff. You know, he's kind of a junk dealer, really. That's what his main thing is.
Wow, that's nice.
but he, I love him to death. And he's my favorite bass player. But he would like dig up these things once in a while and send them to him. It's like, oh my gosh, someone is, you know, paying $30 for that 7-inch or something, you know, and we would. You know, that to me was like, well, I guess there's some people that find the, you know, that did ultimately find these things, these artifacts meaningful. And that's super flattering. And, you know, and so I guess those were the, that would be the moments where you feel like, well, maybe there's some timelessness that you strive for is actually there.
I think that's a really good way of saying it. Like that, the like it's sort of, you're right. Like people forget if you don't remind. Over time, you know, you're going to forget. There's going to be a new generation. But if it's passed on, kind of like NoFX.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, that's just what you give the kid if they say they like punk. It's mm-hmm. it's just what happens. I think it just shows up.
yeah.
Like the whatever the – it just shows up on your phone. And I think like for that to have – you know, that happened for you guys and have Steve from Cave-In, you know, mention that or have, I mean, I definitely, it was one of the bands that was mentioned when you started to get into stuff for me, even like in 97 or 96, it was,
there you go. There's
that's
the
what
moment.
I remember hearing it.
We finally arrived. Thank you.
No, I just, it wasn't like, but the reason I'm asking it is not for you to say like, no, it's really nice. Like, no, like those are things, like you said, seeing the stuff on eBay or seeing them online and being like, wow, people are paying attention to these. Did you think that, I mean, there were probably people were talking about Boys Life and the other bands.
Right.
Like, did you, as you were having your life and moving on and doing all kinds of stuff, did you sense like, wait a minute, I think people remember us. And was there an inkling to do more? Was there an inkling to, did that help? Or did you guys just want to do it because you wanted to do it?
Moving on from there, like I said, I was focused on wanting to try to, you know, I really wanted to write some, you know, country songs. I wanted to write these songs and experiment with a wholly different form that I also realized was, and part of the reason why I picked it, I guess, that the genre of country in a way was that I wanted a generic form of music, what I thought was very generic, because I wanted to tell stories very specifically with very clear language, because I'd been dealing with, you know, writing this abstract stuff for a while through Giant's Chair and the, you know, trying to come up with crazy chord stuff or whatever, time signatures or, but then, when I started to focus on that, I was obsessively focused on it, and I really turned away from Giant's Chair and from rock and from the whole scene. And, there wasn't an immediate, well, I mean, of course there wouldn't be an immediate thing, but years later, I mean, I've done five albums with that, with five country albums, and it was a 20 years of trying to, you know, being a country singer, you know? And so,
right.
And that was the focus and a passionate focus. And so I was never really, I mean, years and years of, you know, not doing anything but thinking I was a country singer and, and not really digging. And then every once in a while, Byron would send something out, you know, send a link to an eBay thing or this or that. So, so then really, you know, what made us want to make a new album was, it's all Paul's fault, the drummer, you know, this damn Green Bay drummer, because we were, you know, we had actually, it's Dwayne, the engineer's fault. That's whose fault it is, because he contacted us and said, "Hey, you guys, I was just listening to." He was going to mix us for a live reunion show. You know, every once in a while, we would get called to do a, you know, we're doing this benefit show or this or that in Kansas City if you guys want to play. And so he had been listening to Purity and Control album ahead of a show we were going to do. And he said, because he recorded that album and it was his first album that he ever recorded. And he's like, "I think we could do a lot better with that. If you guys want to re-record it, we'll do it for free. You guys could relearn the songs and re-record it." And so we thought about that for a minute. And ultimately, Paul said, "Well, wouldn't it be more fun just to see if we could write a new album?" And of course, we thought that did sound like fun. And it was no fun at all, but we did it. No, it was fun. And so that's how the record, you know, how this record came about. We just kind of dove in, and it took a lot longer than it used to take to put a record together because, of course, we're all trying to pay bills and raise kids and stuff now. But damn it, we did it, and we're proud of it.
I love that. And I think that was my next question. I think you guys getting back together and, you know, you're blaming everybody for it, which I love. But what, again, you doing the country stuff for so long, like getting back in there, you had done, I know, the one-off like reunion stuff, but like getting there again and being like, okay, we got to write.
Yeah.
What was the, did you feel like you were 20 again or in your 20s, or did it feel just like home?
Well, it's funny because in a way, I was getting tired of writing country songs too by now. And so I thought, well, this is kind of cool. I mean, I've done some side projects of crazy guitar stuff for theater things here in Kansas City. I also work in theater and I build sets for a children's theater here.
And, no way!
Yeah, that's my job. And
that is your job now?
Yes, that's my job.
That is so cool. Okay. So building sets and like I have a family friend that does it for TV shows.
Oh,
in
cool.
Chicago.
Awesome.
They're like, they do, you know, whatever the all those TV shows that need like the crazy sets and stuff.
Yeah, like
they build all
like
those, and it's like,
or
no, like Chicago Fire,
oh,
or whatever those
show,
like,
yeah. TV shows, like series,
like TV shows.
Oh, wow,
yeah. But like that kind of like, if someone will be like, "Oh, how did you know? Oh, where did you get that?" And I'm like, "No, we built this."
Yes. That's right. Yeah, that's exactly what I do.
From nothing.
Yep.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, I've done weird guitar projects. Like we did at the theater, we did an Edgar Allan Poe thing that I designed the set for, built it and painted it, and then did live guitar weirdness for the show every time, you know, live underscore. And then there was another one. We did Night of the Living Dead at some point where I was like a zombie doing weird guitar stuff to just in the meantime. So and other kind of soundtracky things I had done over the years. So I'd still was playing electric and still dabbling in, you know, just creating stuff in that world. So it wasn't that hard to get back and just sit on the couch really and start coming up with these guitar parts. Which is the way we always wrote, you know. I would bring I'd say, "Hey, I kind of got this and this and this." And then we'd just kind of try to mash them together and see what Byron and Paul threw down on it. And so that part,
I love that, like that back and forth of you want it really simple, not simple, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
CFG. And then you're like, okay, cool. I want to like get a little angular and a little weird and cool. Theater's perfect for that. So I'll be weird with the theater. And then you're weird with Giant's Chair.
Yeah. What are you going to do? I'm just going to keep doing it. I'm a lifer. The music came, I'll say, pretty easily. I mean, like I said, it did take much longer than it used to come up with enough songs for an album, but but the music was pretty easy. The lyrics, though, like coming back to be, you know, being a rock vocalist after doing, you know, this country character really for 20 years, that was a thing. I mean, it wasn't that it was hard to, you know, it's not like you're trying to sing, you know, it's not like I have that I'm trying to sing in a different style. I mean, the country stuff is very much a style, and it's a traditional style, and it's, you know, it's a vocal tricks really in a way, but with singing with Giant's Chair anyway, and I guess emo or rock, like I said before, it's an emotive, experience that, you know, you're just really expressing more, you know, that's the thing. It's more full expression than a style. I mean, maybe that makes it a style, but you're not conscious. Yeah. You're not as conscious, you know, it's not as conscious of a type of singing, I think, ideally, you know, I mean, that makes it, that's the truth of it, you know, if you're trying to be truthful. And then, but lyrically, you know, so writing the guitar was not bad. You know, just kind of belting out these, you know, the words are not bad, but really deciding, like, but writing the words, the lyrics was definitely a journey, because, I'd been writing so straightforward for so long now, and I love abstract poetry, I guess, or, you know, writing that way, and just kind of throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks. But I wanted to have a little bit more cohesion, but without necessarily telling straight up stories. So it's been, mm-hmm. I'm not sure what happened. I feel good about what we put down, and I'm, you know, proud of it. And I think I like the images, and I hope it's got something that, you know, someone gets something from. I feel like it's good, but it was a journey, definitely.
You're happy about it. That's good.
Yeah.
That's what matters. So talk a little bit about the record. And it's called Prefabulon, right?
Yes.
So Prefabulon, is there anything, any songs in particular worth mentioning, or things for people to listen out for, when they hear it?
We are definitely in a more angsty time than we have been for the last, you know, 15 or so, 20 years maybe. And I really feel like when it, you know, it just happened that we were writing a rock record, I felt it more than I was just probably ready to write something with this kind of energy. I mean, there, you know, I do, speaking again lyrically, I think it does veer into, you know, some political stuff here and there. And I mean, I'm frustrated, you know, I think it's just driving me nuts, this everyday ridiculousness. And, so I don't know. I mean, I don't know that I would, I don't want to lead anybody's emotions as they're trying to listen to this record. I just hope they would listen to it and, you know, like to rock out to it. And I think it's a good record, super loud. That's what we go for. but you know, for me, it was a cathartic experience, just trying to deal with this, for, you know, ridiculous bullshit every day that comes down the pipe. And not just, you know, there's that, but there's also the, you know, just the, you know, general life frustration as a human. You know, it's like you do get older. I didn't want to just be like ranting about stuff. You know, who wants to hear an old dude rant? But, you know, at the same time, fuck it. This is my therapy, my therapy process. So I'm going to do whatever comes out. So anyway, I hope there's someone else out there like me. Maybe they get something from it, you know.
And I think your point of, like, you know, struggling and having this sort of, you know, confliction of like, I want to talk about this. I don't want it as this way. And, you know, you're trying to say it the right way. It's like, those are honest.
Yeah.
Those are, you're trying to figure it out.
Yeah. I think so. I hope so. Well, I do know I am trying to figure it out. I know also that I'll probably never figure it out, but it's all about the grind, man.
Is that what you tell your kids?
I try to. Try to tell, but they don't understand yet. They will.
You haven't. Have you said that to them? Have you said, guys, it's all about the grind?
Oh no, I did have a conversation.
Sit on dad's lap.
It's all about the grind. Not yet. They're still pretty young. There's a 10-year-old and a 4-year-old, but
10-year-old should definitely be thinking about the grind.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to. I don't want to scare him off from mowing the lawn. But he's starting to mow the lawn, and I just try to, you know, I don't want to you know, push him too hard with, you know, on the language front just yet. But I did, right. But yesterday I did have to talk to him about I got to drop the old dadage of if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
What happened?
Well, he's trying to. He's got a, you know, he's into Magic the Gathering cards, you know,
yeah.
So he's kind of like, I mean, that's not the only thing he's into, but he's been into that, and I kind of dig it because it's totally analog.
You just
know?
Treated Magic the Gathering like emo.
I did what? Oh, yeah, I did?
You treated Magic the Gathering like emo. You're like,
No,
it's funny because he's like, dude, he's into Magic the Gathering, but he's into other stuff. Just say it. He's into Magic the Gathering. I support him.
Okay, I do too. And that's what I say. I was like, but I, oh, no buts. He's into Magic the Gathering, and it's analog entertainment, and I love it.
Yes.
No buts. And so he's got a buddy at school who is like, man, I've got these cards, and I just ordered these cards on eBay, and they're worth a lot of money, and I'm going to give you a couple of them, and blah, 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 you know, and I'm like, this sounds too good to be true, you know. Anyway, I just had to be like, but I tried to temper it with, it's fun to imagine, and maybe it'll work out. And I did also tell him this morning on the same front, you know, because he woke up and was talking about it, and I said, well, I'll tell you what, if it's all as you say, I will eat my hat. So now, hopefully I don't have to eat my hat, but, you know.
I like that. I like that you had to have a little sit down, explain what's going on.
Well, I didn't make it too intense. It was just like, well, I think that's really cool, and I hope it works out, but sometimes.
Has he asked about your band? Has he asked about, like, hey, Dad, I heard you in an influential mid-90s emo band.
No, he doesn't really care. I try. I mean, I play guitar around the house a lot, and they just get tired of it and say, I can't hear my stuff, or I can't do this or that, or that's, you know. I'm like, okay, I'll go out to the porch again. And so,
is that more on the country songs or the emo songs?
Well, it's kind of... I don't know. It's kind of back and forth. It just depends on whatever I'm messing with at the moment.
Right.
I don't think it matters.
So
to them, it's just dad.
I don't think it matters with them. It's they can't hear
noise.
Their iPad. Yeah.
It's dad making noise on the guitar, and it's in my way. It's not what I want to hear. But, you know, maybe they'll come around someday. We'll see.
I love that. I love that he's just like, Dad, I'm trying to watch something.
Yeah, they don't care. They just don't. They have no interest. And then we have this little keyboard that is around the house that, you know, at turns they each pick up and mess around with. And they always, you know, they'll kind of mess with it for a second, but then they ultimately always just push the demo button, and it plays Green Sleeves over and over and over, you know, and just ridiculous. But I guess, you know, I try to tell them, it's like, you know, you can make your own music on that if you want. It's right, here's how it works. But I don't know. I guess that's all you can do. You can't lead them
So I think that, I mean, my role as an uncle and a cousin and a niece and nephew, my job is to make sure that they listen to good music, mm-hmm. and that they understand that there's music after radio. And that's my one goal in life, like just to make sure they understand that.
That's
so
huge.
I think that's all you got to do. I think that's what you got to do. You got to just make sure that he knows that the radio is not it.
Well, yeah, it's true. And he does. He listens to a lot of generic electronica music music. And this is, we'll probably turn our emo noses up to this, but I think it literally stands for no copyright sounds or something. And it's just music that it's on YouTube. There's a million of them. And it's absolute, it's all about it's all about the build and the drop, it's just electronica, which I like. I mean, I love electronica, and I actually get some ideas from some of this stuff. I wish I could get Paul to be able to play some of that, Boots and Cats stuff once in a while, but
There's a genre called NCS, and it's all non-copyright, and that's how they can make the songs and put them up on YouTube because it's not copyrighted.
That's
correct?
How I understand it. It's NCS music, and there's a million of them. Look them up, and that's what my oldest likes to listen to. And then Avery, the youngest, he likes to listen to year round. It's either Halloween music or Christmas music.
Really?
Year round. That's his thing. It's one or the other. That's it.
Wow. So car rides.
Yep.
That must be an interesting mix.
It is.
Like, I bet Spotify has no idea what to do with you guys.
I don't know. So we just have to rely on YouTube.
So you listen to music through YouTube?
Yeah, a lot. That and Pandora.
Nice.
Yeah.
And yep, because Pandora's just kind of set it and forget it for Christmas.
Yes, so. Yes, for sure.
Avery wants Christmas, so yes. Just hit a button and good
right.
to go.
Yeah, unless he's doing Halloween that day. And we'll listen to, of course, then we go to Nightmare Before Christmas, which is the ultimate mashup between the two, and then... So he listens to remixes of This Is Halloween and stuff. That's good.
Wow.
Yeah.
He is deep on those holidays.
He is. He is.
So that's how to get to Avery as a music industry person myself. I just need to have my artist make Halloween songs for him.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
You okay. Could, you got it. I'm on it.
Definitely make that happen.
I bet you've learned a lot. Like, I mean, it's like knowing what they're into and what they, how they listen to things. Because as we mentioned before, like, it's not phone calls and emails and looking through a zine.
Oh yeah,
it's it's a space bar or a search bar, and you're done.
It is. It's true. I mean, I don't know how much more ignorant I would be without these kids, leading the way, and I appreciate it, really. I mean, I know that I'm an idiot in general, and so it's pretty good to have these little gurus come into my life.
Well, you made them.
Yeah.
All right?
Yep.
You're not an idiot, Scott. You made them.
Well, we'll see. I don't know. Who made who? Nobody knows.
Cool. anything else you wanted to mention? Anything else you want to mention?
I don't know. I just appreciate all the questions, and we're trying to get out and play as often as we can. We're kind of doing weekend warrior type things. So, of course, Midwest is probably going to see more of us sooner than anyone else. But our hope is to try to get out there and play a few shows for anybody who cares. So thanks. If you see we're coming, try to get out, get a babysitter or something.
This is the babysitter core era. Like, this is the one where you got to get.
Man.
So Quicksand came through New York, and there was like sold out immediately.
Yeah.
And I said, no, there'll be tickets. That's babysitter core. that night before something happens, there will be tickets floating. And there were.
Oh, perfect.
Countless tickets on Facebook. Oh, I can't go anymore. My wife can't get home in time.
Oh, like, damn.
Selling fate. Yeah, but that's what's going
to
happen.
It happens. Hey, it does. Well, that's good. That, you know, that attests to the longevity of the genre, right?
Exactly. They will buy the ticket and then realize they can't go.
Hey, just buy the ticket. Somebody, yeah. We'll deal. We'll just assume we'll assume every empty seat was at once purchased.
Yes, that's it. Wow, seated venues for Giants chair. Wow, that's big.
That's right. If it's an empty house, it's a full house, really. And thanks to everybody who's, if you're waiting and have been so patient, because this has been taken forever, but we've finally got some things in the works, and it's coming. The presses are running, so.
You know all about that?
A little bit. Not much. Paul actually took the reins on this one.
Oh, he did. Okay, he let you
the technical side of it. I made some artistic decisions, but he's the one who knows.
We'll just leave you to the kids' theater.
Do what?
We'll just leave you to the kids' theater.
Yeah, the Coterie Theater in Kansas City. It's a thing. It's a huge thing, and I'm proud to be a part of it. We do a lot of cool things. It's all ages theater, I should say. We do sometimes we do little kids shows, but like right now we have a civil rights show that's pretty heavy about the freedom rides and stuff. So.
Wow. I love that. The jobs that people have, that's more I enjoy hearing the stories. Like enough about the shows. Like, who gives a shit? Like, oh, band played and then another band played?
Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing. You wait for 45 minutes or you wait all day for 45 minutes and then you're done. No, what's cool is, oh, you're a JV high school girls basketball coach. Tell me all about that.
Exactly. Yes. Yep. I get it too. Like, I mean, is this your only gig or what do you do? What else do you do?
I work in the music industry. I work at Atlantic Records.
Awesome.
But I've worked at punk and hardcore labels and, I've been in the label side and I stopped making music myself years ago to be on the biz side.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is my fun. When I get home from work, I do Washed Up Emo.
That is awesome.
But people do think it's my full-time job.
Hey, you sound like it could be. I'll send, whenever, if I ever make a buck, I'll send it your way to help pay your first paycheck as this guy.
I'm good. I'm good. See, that's the thing about, actually, that's a really good, like, tie-in. Like, I don't make money on this. I don't need money.
Yeah.
I don't want money. I have some people Patreon me to like pay my server and like some, you know, things that just like, sure, if you want to put money toward it, but I don't like outwardly, you know, say you have to pay me or this podcast stops, but it keeps it level. It keeps it real. If that, you know, like
totally.
I don't need to feel like, oh fuck, I need to do 5 episodes this month to like make my number or something. And I think for your era, and obviously, as it got later, there was a pressure to sound a certain way or to be. But I think, yes, you guys still wanted to make records and sell them. And Bernie at Caulfield wanted to sell them. But I don't think there was the public eye on you in that time period to make it.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Totally. Yeah. It really is all about, you know, the passion of it. You know, it's like you do it, you do it because you want to and because you're driven or, you know, it's in you, whatever. I mean, and that's the truest place of all, you know.
But that's the thing about that. I think the emo, we didn't talk about it, but, you know, sort of the time when that word got popular.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if there weren't kids showing up, would they still be doing it? Yes, a bunch of them, a bunch. Yeah. And definitely for the 90s too. If no one showed up, maybe that band stopped.
Right.
But I do think there's a group that was just like, no, we just kind of have to do this. This is what we're doing.
You know, it's funny. I see this too. Like we're starting to play these, you know, we're trying to play just all ages situations. And it's so refreshing and so sort of a revival for us because you know, there are these art spaces or, you know, whatever. And of course, yeah, they have their, you know, quirky funkiness that is frustrating, you know, if it's like, I don't know, so-and-so's supposed to be here. Oh, I don't know. I'm running the show tonight, you know, this kind of stuff. But it just exactly is absolute bootstrap rock and roll of, or, you know, creativity. And these people and these kids and these bands are making sound because they want to make sound and they want to push the limits and see what they can wrench out of themselves and their instruments. And it is so cool and it is so inspiring, you know, and it's still happening. And
yes,
it's so cool. I mean, and it will always happen. I mean, people make things, you know, that's what we do. We just have to, you know, grind along and make noise, I guess. And I'm glad it works. It helps.
You're exactly right. It is still happening. If you think it's not, then you haven't gone down and driven by, you know, that practice space or that, like, that coffee shop that at night has a show.
Yeah.
Like, it's happening. And that's what keeps me going. Like, there's a band that I, you know, there's bands that send me demos all day and I love listening to them because you can hear it.
Oh,
you can hear that they're like, I'm giving you everything I have inside of me. And here it is. And maybe that's to me emo. Maybe that's to me that sort of scene of like, you're doing this because you have to and there's no other thing telling you, like, I'm going to be huge.
Right.
I'm going to be the biggest band ever. That's not the goal.
Exactly.
The goal is, as you said earlier, you had to get it out. You had to do that. And I think that's, if someone does ask you that again or if someone asks me, that's my answer. It's like, I don't have a choice.
Yeah, well, it's just what, you know, it reminds me of you know, like some art institute instructor who was a, you know, painter, and it's like, he said something about, you know, I have to draw or paint every day. I have to. It's like breathing. It's just, it's that, you know, it is it. It is what keeps me going. And, you know, you just, I don't know, it's strange, but it's expressive, you know, or expression, I guess, because otherwise it just balls up and maybe it just dissipates.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I don't think so. I think it just comes out some way or another.
Yeah, and if it comes out in that way positively, in that way, that's when you're creating something. Yeah, that's it. And I think, I mean, we figured out emo today, but that's really that's the apex of it. And I think you guys were at such an interesting moment in the history. And to be able to cultivate that and for you guys to be around and be able to still be friends, still alive, still be friends and make music is almost a miracle and in itself. And it's like you guys are taking full advantage of it. And I think it's awesome you guys have a new record and you should continue to make music.
Well, I'm starting to write. We'll see what happens.
I love when you answer the dad way. Like, you've got this, like, well, Tom, dad's going to bed, but I'm going to maybe write a couple things.
I'll be out here on the front porch with my git fiddle.
If you need me. Oh, I love that. Sweet. Scott, this was fun. I hope you had fun.
I did. Thank you, Tom. It's so cool. And I thank you for doing it, and thanks for putting it up and all that.
And I'm just stoked that you guys are still around.
Yeah, here we are. Same old crusty dudes. Why not?
Why not?
Why not?